Hey, everybody. Welcome to the NFL Roadshow. Hope you're having a good week so far. It's a lot quieter on the NFL front than the last week of February typically is. Usually, this is the week that the NFL world descends on Indianapolis, and we're all watching around-the-clock coverage of 40 times and three cone drills, processing the latest leaked information surrounding someone's interviewing skills and whether it's going to tank his status at the top of the draft. Obviously, none of that is happening this year for pandemic-related purposes. So instead, we are monitoring pro days, looking forward to free agency, and the possibility of the franchise tag being handed out. That window now officially open as of today, the day you're probably listening to this, Tuesday the 23rd, and it will remain open until March 9th. The thing I want to talk about today, though, or at least frame today's conversation with, is the bit of news that came out late last week that kind of impacts all of those elements of the offseason that are upcoming, and that is the salary cap, which, depending on where you get your news, has either increased this year or shrunk. We'll talk about which it actually is and why it matters to your team, regardless of who your team is. All of them are going to be affected by it for reasons that we'll hopefully try to clarify without this feeling like an advanced economics class, which frankly would go way over my head. So all of that said, my guest today to hold my hand through all of this and hopefully help you make sense of the ways that this offseason is likely to be a little bit different is former Jets general manager and Dolphins vice president and current ESPN front office insider Mike Tannenbaum, who's also just launched a brand new website that I think that you will very much enjoy called The 33rd Team. So without further ado, let's break the huddle. Mike, it's good to see you.
Lindsay, great to be with you. Congrats on your podcast.
Thank you so much. Congrats on your website. I've been perusing it all morning here. Very good content. You've got some great people on board.
Yeah, very, very fortunate. So extremely fortuitous. Shortly after leaving the Dolphins, Bill Polian retired from ESPN, and Bill's a Hall of Fame GM. And there was an opening and timing was great. And literally the first assignment was, hey, we want you to do the draft for ESPN Radio. And I just knew going back to, you know, running a team that there's no way you could adequately prepare for the draft by yourself. So I'm very close with the UMass Sports Management Program, which is about 45 miles from Bristol, Connecticut. And I do a lot there. My family does a lot. We have scholarships to help young men and women start their careers in sports management. And it's been just a big part of my career. And it's a very special place to me. So we started a program where a number of students helped me prepare for the draft. It went so well that the program started to give credits to have students work with me in terms of writing scout reports or doing a lot of like sort of like deeper dive analytics. And what I quickly stumbled into by sheer luck was there was a number of great coaches and GMs that were between opportunities, and some would just stop by. We started having this weekly Zoom call, and it's turned into this like recurring sort of weekly call. And from that, we started a newsletter. If you go to the 33rdteam.com, we have a free newsletter. We have zero revenue. We are a complete authentic think tank, and really proud and privileged to be with really great, high quality coaches. Some have been with us and gone back to teams. We've joked that Dan Quinn was our head coach defensive coordinator and Jerry Jones tampered with him, and the 33rd team, we lost them. But fortunately there's been a couple other coaches that have transitioned on. And then from a front office standpoint, Joe Banner's been really involved and been really helpful to me just setting it up and been like a thought partner. And he's just, a guy that's contributed a lot to the site and just has a lot of instincts in and around that space. And we've had a number of GMs, Ray Farmer, just a ton of guys over the top last year and a half that have popped in. Again, some coaches have gone back to the NFL, some back to Division One, and then we've also added some player personnel people from colleges, and they're really good in knowing the recruits and their background. So from a character standpoint, last year I felt as prepared as if I was with the team, from having scout reports, watching tape, to really having like analytics or predictive information. I really feel like we nailed Justin Herbert, talked a lot about him last year. And then from a character standpoint, like we had information going back to high school from these personnel directors that really went into the weeds. So it's been great. I've learned a lot, and hopefully it either helps coaches get back to where they want to go, Lindsay, or it helps young men and women get to where they want to go in terms of breaking into their careers in football.
Well, I tell you what, as a consumer, the website's right up my alley, because I am the type of fan that loves the off season of football. I mean, obviously I love the season too, but the strategy involved with the off season, the puzzle of it all, kind of trying to figure out the right pieces that go together, the draft, all of it. And frankly, having come from the television space, I'm not sure that this is a part of the NFL calendar that sports TV ends up kind of thriving in, for the most part, primarily because there aren't that many people with your background that are in sports television. So there are a lot of conversations around this time that are fun conversations to be had, but perhaps are not totally rooted in practicality. Like, you could go, hey, so-and-so is a free agent. Where should he go? Turn to a former player analyst who says, I'd love to see him on player A, you know, team A, but team A doesn't have any cap room or anything like that. So I love getting information that's actually practical and coming to me from that lens, which brings me to the cap, actually, because we now know that the salary cap floor is going to be $180 million. What does that mean when I say salary cap floor?
Yeah, Lindsay, great question. So much is about the cap, meaning how much money you can spend in any given year, but there's also a floor. And that was something that was jointly agreed upon by the league and the Players Association. And in the recent extension, which, by the way, was like a year ago, and it feels like 1,000 years ago because it was pre-pandemic. But it's really to make sure that all teams are spending at least a minimum amount of money. And that's important because now between the floor and the ceiling, the whole idea is two things. A, the players are getting their fair share of the pie from the shared revenue. And then B, from a competitive standpoint, teams are hopefully in a closer bandwidth. Now, in any given year, we can get into cash over cap and bigger bonuses and spreading it out. But the essence of it is between the floor and the ceiling, you're going to have teams closer together. And hopefully that's good for the sport. And again, players are now assured that, you know, owner X isn't pocketing money and not spending enough on their players.
Okay, so the salary cap floor is essentially the minimum that a team can spend, and then there is a ceiling that we don't yet know for 2021 that will be the maximum. Last year's maximum was 198.2, I believe.
Yeah.
What are your expectations about what ballpark we're going to be in, and when we'll find out that number is for this year?
Yeah, here's what's really interesting. You're asking a very, very simple question and a very complicated answer for a number of reasons. It's been widely reported, Lindsay, that the current negotiations are going on for the TV rights deals, which are very significant dollars and huge drivers of ultimately what the cap is. Not to go into too much detail, but the salary cap is comprised of multiple revenue streams, most principally the TV dollars, and they are rumored to go up substantially given the popularity of our sport, which is great for everybody. With that said, ordinarily, they sort of tier up where they're starting lower in year one and they ramp up. So one of the ideas that's been kicked around is, well, maybe we just make year one a little bit higher and then maybe we pull that back and borrow against that. So the cap's decrease is minimal. And I will say this as someone that sits in the media right now, I think for the health of our sport, we want to minimize the amount that the cap goes down, because when you look at all the constituents that sit around the table, Lindsay, be it owners, players, agents, whomever, it's really not good for anybody for the cap to go down. So the notion of pulling money back to this year from future years, I think long-term, is for the health of the sport, if possible.
Is there anyone that a lower cap number would benefit at this point? Like teams that have maybe planned for it once the pandemic started and put themselves in a healthier financial position? Whereas if we kind of, I guess a team like that could look at it as a bailout for the other teams if the floor is artificially raised.
Yeah, no, it's a very fair point. But I think it's a very brief moment in time. And when you're running a team and you're in charge of strategic planning, if you're going to have one tough year, you could work around that, because from a cash standpoint, you could give player X a bigger signing bonus and then you could prorate it out over the life of the contract, which lowers the cap number in year one. So theoretically, I think your point's a good one. However, I think more teams could work around that. But certainly there'll be a handful of teams that say, hey, look, you know, we've planned for this. We were responsible. Those other teams need to pay the piper. But I think from a big picture macro standpoint, a lower cap really isn't good for the overall system. Plus, there's a tremendous intangible as well, Lindsay. There's going to be a number of players that are, and we can just focus on the Kansas City Chiefs and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers for a second, the two Super Bowl teams, which is there's going to be a number of really good players in that middle class that are going to get squeezed. So take, for example, the Chiefs, Daniel Sorensen, a really good starting safety. Sammy Watkins, a really good receiver. But when Patrick Mahomes' cap number goes from $5 million over $20 million and the cap goes down, the middle class is going to get squeezed. And again, that's not really good. You want the Daniel Sorensens and the Sammy Watkins to be paid representatively. I think what's going to happen is we're going to see more guys in the have-nots. Likewise with Tampa, you know, they have Chris Godwin and Levante David and Shaq Barrett and Dominican. They have a number of free agents. There's no way they can keep all of them. And they're going to overpay a couple to keep. And then some of those others are have to graduate.
I'm looking at the teams here, the salary cap information on Over the Cap. And it looks like there are 13 teams as of right now that are in the red. So they have some work to do to get back in the black prior to when. And by the way, what happens if teams don't get under the salary cap?
Yeah, they hang you upside down by your ankles until you do. So so basically, you have until the night before free agency begins, the first day of league year, which I believe is March 13th. So March 12th at midnight, all teams will be under the cap. Basically, what happens is you can't not be under the cap. They will force you to make transactions so you are in cap compliance. You know, a couple of years, we've kind of cut it close, but nowhere to like a midnight deadline. And you basically, what happens is you also tender your players. And what I mean by that, starting tomorrow with the franchise tag and then with exclusive rights players.
This Monday.
Yep, that's right. Excuse me. Today being Tuesday. restricted free agents and then exclusive rights where a player's contract may have expired and they don't have a contract. You have to tender all these players. Those count against the cap as well. And all that. During the offseason, when your roster goes up to 90, Lindsay, only 51 cap charges count against your cap. So those other, in this case, 49 won't count initially. That's what you have to be in cap compliance, what's known as top 51 in the offseason.
Do you think we're going to see more high-priced veterans cut this year because of the lower cap number?
No doubt. We're taking a long look at that right now. Household names, guys like, for example, like Malcolm Butler, he's a good corner. But he may not be able to stay at his salary. Most notably, someone like Ben Roethlisberger. I just don't see Pittsburgh bringing him back, Lindsay, on a one-year deal at his cap number. I think those are going to be some really hard and painful conversation. Pittsburgh's done a great job. You know, you think about this historic run that, you know, it's been Roethlisberger and Tomlin for so long. To me, in my opinion, that's coming to an end. You know, I think Pittsburgh has the fourth best quarterback in the AFC North. And every day they keep Ben Roethlisberger, Lindsay, they're stopping progress. They have to move on. Those are hard conversations. I know in my career, be it the Jets or the Dolphins, those are the harder decisions where there's really good players that have been successful for you. And when you need to move on, it's hard. It's easy to say and hard to do.
So Ben Roethlisberger's contract right now counts for about $41 million against the cap. If they cut him, he counts for $22 million against the cap. So they'd get a lot of money back, but this is a move that you wouldn't make just primarily based on finances, right? You just think it's the right time to move on from Ben Roethlisberger from a football standpoint too, or is it primarily motivated by money?
It's both, Lindsay. He's a skilled diminished player. Father time has caught up with him. He's not the same guy. And I know they started off 11-0, but a lot of the throws he made, candidly, most quarterbacks can make. He can't extend plays like he wants to. He had a great career. He's going to the Hall of Fame. He has nothing but a lot to be proud of, but it's time to move on, and he's not the same player. And then you factor in the economics, as you mentioned, the $19 million that they're going to pay him. It just doesn't make sense. And the challenge is, Lindsay, if you do keep him for one more year, which you certainly can make the argument to do that, and we're having this conversation – in February of 2022, like, you are stopping progress. Joe Burrow just got a year better. Baker Mayfield got a year better. Lamar Jackson got a year better. And now what are you, you're Pittsburgh? You can't go well with Mason Rudolph. So what are you going to do? And that's, to me, the conundrum that the Steelers are in. They need to make a change at the quarterback position for the next, hopefully, then 10, 15-year run. That player is not on campus right now.
Yeah, it was obvious that his inability to push the ball downfield this season, especially later in the season, affected the types of defensive coverage that they faced. So you said that the quarterback is not on campus right now. That's Mason Rudolph and Dwayne Haskins, a late add there in Pittsburgh. So what do they do? Do they draft? Do they find a bridge, go get a Ryan Fitzpatrick or a Jameis Winston, or trade for Darnold? Or what's the right answer there?
Yeah, yes, yes, and yes.
Look, All of the above. Go do it all.
Yeah.
Try them all.
Yeah. I love the Haskins sign, by the way, because there's no downside and only upside. And hopefully Dwayne Haskins learns from his prior experiences in Washington. With that said, I would, when you have a problem, there's some vernacular that the teams I've been, we use, which is there's needs and there's musts. Quarterback is a must for the Pittsburgh Steelers. A must means you can't operate the franchise unless you address it. Need is something that you need to improve to go win your division. Being a must for the Steelers, you need to do both. I would go try to sign Ryan Fitzpatrick or Jameis Winston, and I would try to draft Mac Jones or maybe Trey Lance, depending on who's there when you pick. And this way you have a chance to win for today. And by the way, that defense is ready to win, like, right now, not in 10 minutes, right now. They have a really good defense, and you got to develop the next guy. It's not Mason Rudolph. I doubt it's Haskins. So go get Fitzpatrick, go get Winston, and go draft his long-term replacement.
This is a tricky situation for the Steelers, though, right? Because Ben Roethlisberger, obviously, they have a relationship. They want him to retire as a Steeler. They want the relationship to be intact and things not to get ugly at the end. Kevin Colbert last week said, as we sit here today, Ben is a member of the Pittsburgh Steelers. It feels like he might – that feels very Les Snead-ish, right, toward the end of the Jared Goff, right before they traded him. What do you think are some of the calculations that Kevin Colbert's making at this point, if he, in fact, does want to move on from Ben Roethlisberger?
So one of the many superpowers that Bill Belichick has, and I had the good fortune, Lindsay, of working for him twice, is he will make every decision in an honest, sober, dispassionate way. And if you and I owned a business together, that's exactly the attribute you'd want from the leader. Richard Seymour, Lawyer Malloy, you know, there's two decades of experiences. And he does that better than anyone, and that's exactly what Pittsburgh needs to do. And I've been there. I've sat in the seat. It's hard to tell Mike Pouncey, Chad Pennington, really good player, hey, it's time to move on. It's really hard to do. But if you want to have sustainability and a reasonable cap, you need to do that. And if I'm Kevin Colbert and I'm Mike Tomlin, I'm sitting down with the Rooney family. I'm getting in a room and saying, you know what, guys? We need to honor Ben Roethlisberger. We need to celebrate him. And it's time to move on. And we got to go sign somebody else. Ryan Fitzpatrick's played really good football the last couple of years when you really study the numbers. And there's no reason why you shouldn't sign someone like him. And again, go draft his replacement. There'll be a time and place to honor Ben Roethlisberger, retire his number, watch him go to Canton. But right now, he's just stopping progress, and it's time to graduate.
What about the Saints, who are, what, $69 million in the red right now? They have to make so many moves to get back in the black before they could even think about adding pieces. So they might have a quarterback situation that they're trying to move on from too, maybe not because of their own choices. Maybe Drew Brees is going to retire. Obviously, I think a lot of us think that's what's going to happen. What do they do?
Yeah, it's a pretty similar situation. Drew Brees is a guy that's had a great run, great career, Hall of Famer, who's a height and speed deficient player now. He just looks old and slow, and that's just the honest evaluation of him. And they've done a great job of having Taysom Hill and Jameis Winston being developed behind them. They got to get Winston under contract, with the, which they need to do ASAP. And this is a situation where, again, I think this is a very similar conversation. It's time to move on. It's time to graduate. It's time to honor.
Do you want Winston to be your starter if you're the Saints?
So
when you also have Taysom Hill, and what do you do there?
Yeah. You know, Taysom Hill is a contact player. It would be against the odds. You know, we talked about the 33rd team and studying things like actuarial numbers and predictive analytics. Taysom, it's unreasonable again, if we were running a franchise, we had to feed our family on the probability of Taysom Hill playing 16 games, our kids may starve. And they're certainly, we can't educate them. Like, that has to be the lens of making these decisions. Like, is it a reasonable business proposition to say, hey, Taysom Hill, you're going to play in 16 games? Like, I'm not making that bet. I love him. I want him on our team. He's a contributor. He's a great football player. He's a great teammate. But I'm signing Jameis Winston. And I hope Jameis, who has started 70 games, he's still 27 years old. He's a guy that me that has great upside. So I want them both back. If you go with Taysom Hill, I think we're going to be sitting here in sometime October, November, and I hope I'm wrong by saying this. You just don't – it's hard for me to say that he's going to get through a whole season.
Why did they choose to go with Taysom then in the short term when they lost Drew over Jameis, if Jameis would be their starting option when they're starting a season fresh?
Yeah, that's a great question, Lindsay. And I think what we're talking about are the two competing sort of thoughts that go through everyone's mind when you're running a team, which is – what gives us, as you just said, short term? Taysom Hill could come in, knows the offense. You got to understand, like, offseason program this past year. So Hill knew the offense better. And short term, he probably gave them the better chance of winning. Whereas, you know, with Jameis, it's more of a long-term proposition. And again, when you sign Winston, you really have it through the lens of, could he start for us in September of 21? And I think this is where you try to balance short-term and long-term competing goals.
So we talked about, and the Saints fit into this category of a team that might have to cut a lot of high-profile veterans in order to just get cap compliant. What about veteran trades? Do you think that we'll see maybe more of those this offseason? You've got Calais Campbell, who went to Baltimore for a fifth rounder, right, last year. So you have in the past few years been able to get people that you could plug into your starting lineup without really giving up very much in the past. Will we see more of that this year? Will their value even go down from a trade standpoint because there are more of them on the market?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, we did see that a lot last year. Campbell, you look at the same team, you know, Yannick Ngakoue, that was a great pickup as well. I think it's a possibility, but because of the cap going down, if I was a team, I'd be very reticent to give up a lot in terms of pick compensation, Lindsay. If I think that there's going to be, for example, you need a receiver, it's very likely there's going to be multiple receivers that get cut. Alshon Jeffrey, DeSean Jackson. And again, I know they're not the same player, but if you could get them at a less expensive price, it's certainly something you got to consider from a team building standpoint.
Do you think we might see more short-term deals in free agency this year? Maybe even agents might want short-term deals, knowing that the cap is going to go up in the next couple of seasons, just kind of ride this out while teams don't have very much money and then go hit them hard next year.
Yeah, I think that's a possibility, but I think it depends on leverage. If I'm Dak Prescott, I'm doing a 3-year deal, getting $100 million or more in guaranteed money, Lindsay, and then try and get another bite of the apple. Whereas, again, if you haven't had, you know, a chance to really hit a big deal, let's say someone like Lamar Jackson, and you can get a 7-year deal, I think it'd be hard to walk away from that as well. So I think context will be important, but generally speaking, if you're a good, yes, I think you'd rather go shorter than longer.
That's if Dak hits the open market, right?
It's amazing.
They're not,
I think,
let
the Cowboys 50 million take, you know, Lindsay, we've been talking about this for 2 years. I don't know how they could have signed him 2 years ago. Like, it's incredulous to me that you're going to pay Zeke Elliott, who's holding out in Cabo, before you're going to pay Dak Prescott, who's a productive, high-character player that you can win a lot of games with. It makes no sense to me. And what would have been $32 million a year 2 years ago, it's going to be at least 40. That's $8 million a year that on a 5-year deal, I mean, you're talking upwards of at least 40, upwards of $50 million that they're going to pay that they didn't need to.
How does the injury impact his leverage this offseason?
Yeah, it's a usual situation. It probably helped him because they're not the same franchise without him. Andy Dalton's a nice player, but he's not Dak Prescott. And I think what we saw was his value actually, ironically, Lindsay, I think improved by him not playing. And it's an injury where he should be able to come back completely. And if I'm him, look, I'll play for $37 million and then I'll graduate next year and then look out. If 18 teams needed a quarterback this year, could you imagine what a young, healthy Dak Prescott could command in the market?
You don't think, though, to be clear, that the Cowboys will let him hit the open market, right? They have to either come to a long-term deal with him by March 9th or tag him.
Yes. And what I would love nothing more, if I could be any place in the country in the next month, I would love to be in Jerry Jones's office, because this is one of the very few times, Lindsay, that Jerry Jones doesn't have leverage. And you don't become one of the 32 owners of an NFL team by being a bad negotiator, and you usually have leverage. He doesn't have leverage. So they will tag Dak Prescott. I would love to see him try and getting a deal done when he doesn't have leverage.
We talked about the middle class might go away this year in terms of free agency, but the high-end free agents are still going to get the types of deals that they would typically get, as evidenced by what you think that Dak should command. Who fits into that category? Which of the free agents are like, you know, the guys that are fine regardless of the fact that it's a depressed market?
Yeah, I think one comes to mind, Shaq Barrett, you know, young pass rusher, impactful game in the Super Bowl again. Can never have enough of those. So, and given their situation in Tampa, if Chris Godwin, let's say, gets tagged, I think Barrett will do very well in the market.
What about the draft aspect of this? I mean, there's obviously a trickle down in terms of always what you can't accomplish in free agency, then now you know what you have to do in the draft. Or although what I think is always interesting is the whole argument about not drafting for need and draft best player available. And I've always found it, I mean, in theory, yes, go get the best player available. How hard is it to practically stick to that when you actually have holes that need to be filled and there are people sitting there on the draft board who can fill them for you?
Yeah, that's always one of the most challenging discussions. You really want to stick to your draft board the best you can, because over a 3 to 5 year period, you want the best team you can get and accumulate as many picks, good players as possible. The tiebreak will always go to a need. And this year, I think it's interesting, Lindsay, is I think teams are going to look at the draft and say, like, you know what, we couldn't get Shaq Barrett. And even though we have a lower second round grade on this defensive end, we just got to take him because we need a guy there. So I think we're going to see that a little bit more. Again, that's another permutation of, the cap going down.
How do you evaluate this year's draft class without a combine and that ability to go see all of them in person, one right after another in a comparative sense?
Yeah. A lot of teams don't feel like this year's picks are going to be worth as much. Speaking of the 33rd team, we just did a study on that in terms of, like, historically how much better players are at their pro day compared to the combine. Allen Robinson went from a 4.6 at Indy to a 4.47 at Penn State. Now the joke is, did he run 38 or 39 yards at Penn State? So, you know, the numbers are just not going to be as reliable. And Lindsay, you know, from covering the combine, like, the NFL is such a tradition rich place. Like, we have a person who stands 5 feet away from the starting line, because if someone breathes wrong, they have to rerun. I mean, you think about the tradition and the rules and the gauntlet drills, and I'm just as bad as the next guy. Like, I'm looking at everything. And now we're saying we can't even be there. We're going to have these schools administrate these pro days. It's going to be, I'll tell you what, I just think people are going to discount this year and they're going to ignore the numbers to a large extent.
So then what, you just look at just, it's all tape, what you've put down on tape. That's what we're going to go off of.
Yeah. I think tape, interviews, background, you'll look at the numbers, but again, Allen Robinson to me is a very instructive example.
Yeah. David Carr has told this story many times on NFL Network about how at his pro day, and who cares how fast, you know, David Carr can run a 40, but like one of his friends marked it off. And he's positive to this day that he ran a 39-yard 40 for sure. So, yeah. Can't they kind of do something to, with all the technological advancements, have something kind of maybe where the league steps in, is in charge of the pro day, and they set it up with some sort of mechanism? What's the mechanism that they have at pro days that actually, like, there's like a tracer?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a lot of tracking information now, GPS data. But again, what the big challenge, Lindsay, is you don't have, again, like the starts, you don't know, you're not there. What's the surface? You know, is it exactly even? Is it grass? Is it turf? Again, the start.
Is it wind dated?
Exactly. And really, like, the start is the start. What you don't want to have is rolling starts, right? And that's something that, again, the league does a great job of doing in Indy. So it's just not going to be anywhere close to a perfect system.
Okay, last thing. What happens with Deshaun Watson?
Simple question and a complicated answer. I think the, like, very fundamental question to me is, like, what in the world happened? Like, he signed a contract 6 months ago, Lindsay. Not 6 years ago, not 60, but 6 months ago. And if I'm Cal McNair, I go find Deshaun Watson. I don't care where he is, who he's with. I'm coming to see him. I'm taking my yellow pad. I'm going to come ask a whole bunch of questions because you, Deshaun, are the most important person in this franchise. Not the head coach, not the GM, you. And you're going to be here. And I don't care how many heads we got to lop off, but you're going to be here. So you tell me who needs to go. And we're going to have a very candid conversation. We're going to look each other in the eye and you're going to be here. So let's start talking and you're not going anywhere. I think the massive concern I would have if I was Houston specifically is if they don't trade him, which I think is a very reasonable place for Nick Caserio and David Culley to be. You plan your offseason accordingly. You move on, you draft position players. He doesn't show up in September. And now are you in a Jalen Ramsey situation where now Jalen Ramsey's not practicing for Jacksonville? And that's a huge concern if I'm Houston. And one thing I would say, and again, it's easy to say, I lived it with Darrelle Revis in New York. If I'm Nick Caserio, I'm getting in a room with David Culley and Cal McNair and saying, hey, listen, we're going to give this thing one calendar year. I don't care how noisy it gets. I don't care what you read. 1 year, we are in complete agreement that even if he sits out this year, we are not trading Deshaun Watson. And that's really the mindset they need to have.
That's so hard to practically follow through on, though, if you're going to go into a season without a quarterback. And if he has the stomach to actually sit it out and force it, knowing that he has a career on the back end, no matter what. One thing that you said that I think is the most important thing that you said is, if I'm Cal McNair, because if you're Cal McNair, we're not even at this point. If that's the way you're approaching it with your legal pad telling Deshaun Watson that he's so important to the franchise, I think that's the point that Deshaun Watson's making, right? No one did that for a series of decisions where it was obvious that they should have done that. And he was asking them to do that. And then that still didn't happen. So that's kind of why we are where we are, which would indicate that Cal McNair's probably unlikely to go do that in any way that feels authentic to Deshaun Watson.
Totally fair. I've been in that situation. Chad Pennington, Ryan Tannehill, I actually had them part of coaching searches. We did it in a very quiet and discreet way. And I made it very clear to both guys, like, you are not picking the quarterback. Excuse me, you're not picking the head coach, but your feedback's important. So you're going to talk to a couple of candidates very quietly. They're going to get to know them. You're going to get to know them. Love to get your feedback. But your job is to play quarterback. So I think there's a time and a place where you can do it. I think it happens a little more than people realize. But context is everything, which is, hey, give us your thoughts. And you're a very valued member of this franchise. Again, I'd like to know why, like, not like what happened, but why it happened. Because again, he signed his extension after DeAndre Hopkins left. He had a very emotional press conference. So for this to come off the rails this significantly is very unusual.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see where this goes. It's Mike Tannenbaum. Obviously, you can see him on ESPN all the time. And then go check out the website. It's the33rdteam.com. Tons of great information on there, including you guys are going team by team with on-the-clock write-ups, huh? Like what they should do in the draft, people that your team should be taking a look at?
Absolutely. And we're trying to put ourselves, like, the whole theme is, like, let's go behind the curtain. Let's talk to real GMs, head coaches. What would you do? We had Wade Phillips 2 weeks ago break down Todd Bowles' game plan from the Super Bowl, which was really, really cool stuff. And, yeah, it's been a lot of fun. And, again, I think there's a lot of people that have a lot to add. So it's been a great forum to do that.
Awesome. Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Lindsay. I appreciate this. Great to be with you. And congrats on this podcast.
Thank you. All right. So that's at Real Tannenbaum on Twitter. And hopefully that made some sense to you. And now my husband, who asked me last week as I was going on and on about the lower cap, knows the answer to the question that I could not answer and was very embarrassed that I could not answer. What does happen if you don't get under the cap? You get strung up by your ankles. Very medieval, this modern day NFL. Anyway, have a great rest of the week, and we will meet you back here Friday with another episode of the NFL Roadshow.